The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. As we head into Hour 3, it's a delight, it's a privilege, and an honor to have with me Congressman John Shattuck, former congressman representing Arizona's old 4th Congressional District. He is now the head of Shattuck Associates, LLC, and we like to have him here on Wednesdays every time he's in town. You're looking great. You must be working out. I don't know if you're on a new diet, but you're looking great, John.
Hey, I'm trying. I'm working at it.
Is there anything like the... I guess you've seen it from White Houses, but I was just thinking, is there anything like a congressional cookbook or the congressional diet book or anything like that? There probably wouldn't be a lot of diet books out of Congress, but it could be.
There is definitely a congressional cookbook.
There is a congressional cookbook.
And the recipes in it are submitted by the wives of members of Congress.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they put them out with some regularity. Maybe, I don't think it's every year, but it's like every 5 years or every 10 years. And Shirley has submitted.
What did she submit?
A number of them.
What was her best dish?
She has too many best dishes,
okay,
which is what gets me in trouble. I think she's done a couple of different desserts that I love.
Arlen Specter's wife used to do a
salads,
cheesecake.
A cheesecake.
That they sold at the Palm.
Ah.
She supplied the Palm with their cheesecakes, Arlen Specter's wife. I remember that.
Bob Stump.
Yeah.
His favorite restaurant in all of the world, but certainly in all of D.C., was the Palm.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I take it you've been there.
I have.
Yeah. And with all the drawings of all the members, it's pretty special. I think I know I went with him once.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty
special. Yeah, it's a scene.
Yeah, it is a scene.
It's a scene.
For people who haven't been there, they should go, we should have sent David.
We should have sent him. We sent him to Old Ebbets, which is good.
And less expensive than
Less expensive than the Palm. I had an idea with Dana Perino once. We were buddies, and we would go to dog parks and stuff together because she loved Vishas, and I had Dagny, my Brittany.
Really? And, is this before any of us knew Dana Perino?
No. It was after she was press secretary, and what was she doing at the time? Consulting work.
I got to know her after she went on Fox, and she's a nice person.
Oh, the nicest in the world.
Yeah, just a nice person.
We had the best idea for a book. There are these characters in Washington, D.C., like Tommy, who was the maitre d' at the Palm, for example. And I can't remember their names. But then there's the Mel Crouppen at Once Upon a Time standing outside of his restaurant with the footlong cigar, or the chief, the head hotel clerk at the Adam at the Hay Adams. You know, there are these characters in Washington.
There are a lot of characters in Washington.
And we thought we would make a coffee table book titled If You Want a Friend in Washington, ... And each page would be a profile of these people with their dog.
With their dog.
Wouldn't that be a good
idea? Absolutely.
I think it would have. We took it to Bob Barnett, and he didn't go for it. But we thought it was a great idea.
Serious mistake. I guess I have to add, every time you bring up the name Bob Stump, you have to bring up Lisa Atkins,
okay,
who is here in town and was the head of the State Land Department for many years under Doug Ducey, a brilliant administrator, Bob Stump's right-hand person. She did all kinds of amazing things. But, you know, today we know about members of Congress who are maybe famous or are famous because they did something outrageous.
Yeah, right.
You know, who is the guy that would take pictures of his privates and send them?
Well, it's pretty easy to remember that name. It's Anthony Weiner. Anthony Weiner.
Who was
the guy from Ohio? Be me up, Scotty, and
there
all that.
You.
Yeah.
Do you know what made Bob Stump famous?
No.
Bob Stump, in the great tradition of Arizonans get things done, would get out on the ledge of the Cannon Building and wash his office's windows.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, call Lisa Atkins and ask her.
Clean windows.
Yeah, you know, he's the kind of guy that, hey, they let my windows get dirty. I don't like them dirty. I'm going to get out. And he just, not just his, he'd wash his office and then the reception office and then the staff office.
Clean, clean windows.
Amazing guy.
We had some real characters. I can't, we sent to Congress into the Senate. And anyway, it's Arizona's well represented.
Sam Steiger.
Yeah.
I mean, we had the really in, you know, meritorious ones like Udall or John Rhodes. But we also had the characters like Sam Steiger, who shot a burrow or painted a crosswalk on Gurley Street on Whiskey Row.
And who was that senator who served forever way long ago, who was known for always switching his vote from what he promised? Very low.
Not Carl Hayden.
No, this was years ago. He he's actually plays a kind of a cameo role in the movie Advice and Consent.
Oh, and from Arizona?
Yeah. I'll think of it, or I'll check it out on the break. He wrote a book. He used tremendously complicated vocabulary, and he was known for never maintaining the same position twice.
we could do a whole hour on Arizona political nostalgia.
Oh, we totally could.
Absolutely.
We totally could. I was meeting with Marshall. I got to get Marshall Trimble in here to do that. We had Dolan Ellis on a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, sometimes I fantasize about taking over for Marshall Trimble.
You could do it.
When, you know, if he retires.
You could do it.
It'd be fun.
But he's not retiring anytime soon.
No.
Go, that guy is
He's probably
full.
Younger than me.
He's not, but he moves young. He moves really young. All right, I wanted to run this by you. I think this is something that you would gel to, John Shattuck.
Wait.
Yes, go ahead.
Maybe we need two Marshall Trimbles.
We need two?
So, yeah, he can do his not as focused on politics, and I can do mine more focused on politics.
Okay. All right.
Talk to him about it.
All right. I'm going to bring him in one of these Fridays.
By the way, you can
join us.
Here we go. Here's a pitch.
Okay.
Anybody in your audience who is the speaker host, the person who gets speakers at their Rotary Club or Kiwanis Club or you name it, give me a call and I'll come.
Okay.
Tell political stories.
Oh, good. So, okay. Henry Ashurst.
Henry Ashurst. Absolutely.
That was the senator who never held the same position twice.
There you go.
Yeah. I think he wrote a book too. Okay. This is kind of something that I was talking about in my monologue in the first hour, and it was inspired by just a weird thought I had on my Morning Constitutional with Dagny. I was reading a piece in the Wall Street Journal by someone I generally like, Jason Riley.
I like him.
Yeah. And he was talking about the potential for the Hispanic vote to go towards Donald Trump.
Yep.
And I was thinking about, you know, this time every 2 to 4 years, there are all these speculations, articles, commentaries, prognostications about, will Donald Trump or the Republican Party pick up African-American votes? Will it do better with the Hispanic vote than typically? Has Joe Biden lost the Hispanic? You understand. And now the Jewish vote, I guess, is in discussion as well. And I was speculating, you know, what would it be like? And it couldn't be Joe Biden. But what would it be like if someone like Donald Trump were to give a speech, a national speech, saying something along the lines of, I'm tired of all this conversation about block voting based on race and ethnicity.
Yes.
We're on the brink of too many civil wars here, and the worst of them was fought over race. Why can't we go back, and shouldn't we go back, to the view? I think of John Bingham, the guy who actually wrote the 14th Amendment, one country, one constitution, one people. And I want to hear nothing about black votes. I want to hear nothing about Hispanic votes. I want to hear nothing about Jewish votes. I want to hear about American votes. I want to hear about John Marshall Harlan and Plessy versus Ferguson saying there is no caste here. No one is the master of another. We don't separate Americans by. It's an old-fashioned notion, but not if you were in a 1968 or 67 or 66 speech by Martin Luther King Jr. It wouldn't have been old-fashioned.
No, it wouldn't. He was
or
right
if you
there.
Went to the oral argument of Brown versus Board of Education, it wouldn't have been old-fashioned.
That would have been interesting.
Why couldn't he get would? How
I think
would
it's
that
a great
be
idea.
Received?
I think it's a great idea, and you're singing my tune. You know, I come on and talk about identity politics. What you are talking about is the early iteration of identity politics. It is not that we are Americans. It is that we are this subset. And the importance of the subset, black, Italian, whatever it is more important. And oh, by the way, then we are not one nation under God. We are not unified as Americans. We are these separate identities. And so you start talking about block voting by whatever group it is.
And then you have to make these appeals that are somewhat, what's the word I want, diminishing, self-abasing when you go and, oh, I got to go give a speech to the AIPAC group or the Jewish American group or the Hispanic American group or the Latino American group. So I'll talk about, you know, things that are of interest to them. Why not talk about things that are interesting to everyone in this country and explain to them the piece they have in it? Can we pick up on that on the other side of break?
And by the way, that may be how we have to fix it, is to get those groups to talk about being Americans or one nation first.
Yeah, we may. Yes. It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
And it's going to put a lot of columnists and consultants out of business. But it might put America back in business. John Shattuck and I will pick up on this thought when we come right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, coming to you from the 960 Patriot Broadcast Studio, which is brought to you by the veteran-owned Midas Gold Group, your trusted source for precious metals. Speaking of Midas Gold Group, John Shattuck, this Henry Ashurst, this senator who does play a cameo in Advice and Consent, if you ever see that old movie, it's an eerie movie, but he's the senator that's always falling asleep and they're waking him up and telling him how to vote when he wakes up from his nap. But he was a U.S. senator here until I think about 1941, and he was like the pre-Buckley user of 75-cent words.
Really?
So the reason
he was ahead of my time.
Yeah, a little ahead of your time, but he said, I love auriferous words. I was thinking auriferous, that means gold, A-U. Right, auriferous words. He says, I suffer from cacothes loquendi. Mania for talking. These are the kinds of things he did, and he wrote a book.
That's me. I talk too much.
You talk too much. All right. So let me try this thought with you. I was curious, circa 2020, 4 years ago, this notion of the word woke. Where did it come from? The word woke. Where did it come? So I did the best I could, and I found the first use of it in the New York Times was in 1962. And it was written by an African-American writer. It was an op-ed by an African-American writer named Melvin Kelly, who's not much remembered anymore. And it was an op-ed he wrote about using that word because he was offended, John, by seeing all this new trend of Madison Avenue advertising in the New York subways aimed at ethnicities. So stereotypes of black or African-American, I guess they would have been called black. In fact, they were even called Negro in those days. That's what his op-ed uses that word. Where they aimed the language at the particular dialects that they thought were, you know, used in that community, where they kind of used the stereotypical directional advertising at these communities. And he wrote this in his op-ed in 1962. He said, the American, his word, can I say it? He, 1962, said the American Negro realizes that anything which sets him apart will keep him apart. All he wants is a good job, a safe street, and a nice home. And I thought when I read that, how far we've come from the notion that just because someone is of a certain ethnic or minority race, they have different interests and desires in this country.
Nope.
And that's what this block voting appeal, why it, I think, offends me so much.
It is clearly offensive, and it debases us as a nation. As we talked about as recently as last week, the idea was one nation under God, meaning all of us had essentially the same view of equality before the law and of equal rights and of the American dream, not the American dreams. It was that we were a nation, and rather than being a nation based on where we were located physically, like France or Germany, but rather being a nation based on a set of principles spelled out in the founding documents by the people of the time. And they were not transient. They were things that were true for all time, like equality or like equal opportunity or like equal justice under the law. And to have strayed from that is tragic.
I guess I was thinking about this, too, in the context of the civil rights heroes that you and I kind of grew up learning from and about. I every once in a while go back and try and reread different and maybe less famous speeches of Martin Luther King, because he was prolific and people only know one or two of his speeches or of them. But he was quite prolific. And at Monmouth University, he said this in 1966, John. "We've heard a lot of talk over the last few months of black power, and we've started hearing talk of white power. But I don't talk about black power or white power. I would prefer to believe in a kind of striped power where black and white together, where we work to achieve the legitimate power that all of God's children must have to function in life. There is no white path to power and fulfillment, short of chaos, that does not share that power with black aspirations for freedom and human dignity. What we must come to see is that we are tied together. All our music, all our language, all our material prosperity, even our foods are an amalgam of black and white. So the Negro needs the white man to save him from his fears, and the white man needs the Negro to save him from his guilt. But we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality." Boy, that's been lost.
Completely. And tragically. Well, because we are taught on a daily basis that we began as a racist nation, and that none of the deeply held thoughts crafted into the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence were genuine, which is completely wrong. If you look at it, you have to assume that they were, that the founders were in fact incredibly cynical, and so that they wrote things like the rule of law or equality under the law or equal justice, never intending them, that behind that they meant, oh, no, this doesn't apply to anybody else, or doesn't apply, only applies to certain Americans, not to all. And, yeah, there was a reality of the time which, in the span of writing those documents, could not be undone, namely slavery, which began before the formation of the nation, indeed centuries, and had existed since the beginning of time. No, they couldn't fix that. But when they could, they did. And we just don't take account of that fact.
I sometimes think that if Martin Luther King were to be revivified and go to a college graduation where they had separate black commencements, or as they now often have, separate black housing, he would ask what the heck happened. He would ask, isn't this what we fought and
right.
did sit-ins to oppose? But there's something even deeper that I'm going to try and get my hands on around this. What is the message these things send to the white community or to the non-African American community? Isn't it a message also saying we can never be integrated and we will always be different from you? Isn't it kind of a reaffirmation and a reification, a reinstantiation that there will never be integration in this country because there never can be? Isn't that what it's telling white people? We can't graduate with you. We can't live with you.
Great question. I don't know. It does say we will never be believed.
Yeah. Yeah.
No matter what we do, no matter how much, well, we have a revolution. We abolish slavery. We enact the Civil Rights Act. We enact affirmative action. We struggle down the line again and again and again to try to correct things. But because we can't get to perfect, then there is no hope.
Yeah. Okay. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Congressman John Shattuck is my guest. He is the founder and principal at Shattuck & Associates, LLC, consulting, law, and public policy work. Let me switch topics on us, John, for a little bit here. I was watching some of the hearings today where Hunter Biden's former business partners, including Tony Bobulinski, were up against it with the House Democrats. And I noticed this a little bit about a week or so ago in a back and forth with Robert Hur, the former special counsel in the Trump in the Biden investigations on classified documents, in a back and forth, in a byplay with Congresswoman Jayapal out of California. You've conducted any number of those kinds of hearings and Q&As with witnesses. I don't remember congressmen interrupting as much the witnesses as they used to with this is my time business. The Congress people now say this is my time. This is my time, when they're trying to interrupt and stop an answer they don't want the complete answer to from, you know, a witness that might not be on their side. Is this new? Am I just wrong about this?
No. And
by what right does a congressman have to say to a witness, this is my time? I thought this was the people's house.
It is the people's house, but more importantly, when you have a witness in front of you, it is the witness's right to make their statement and to make it as completely as they need to make. It is absolutely new. I don't think in my 16 years in the United States Congress, I ever heard a congressman say that to a witness. Occasionally, they might say, taking back my time, or they might say, excuse me, but I want to make this point, or I want to flesh out this issue you just raised. But now the whole institution is more coarse and less respectful of each other and of witnesses.
I'm not wrong. This is kind of new.
Nope, okay. It's new. Okay. And the other thing that shocks me is, and I've discovered, now that we no longer have a press that would pretend or endeavor, at least to some degree, to be fair and not partisan, we have a situation where members of Congress or politicians in general will repeat a lie over and over and over and over and over and over again, knowing that it's false and that any idiot would understand it's false. But I think what they're doing is just pitching to the people who don't think, who simply don't think. For example, on the issue of Biden's corruption and his dealings with his son, every time a Democrat speaks, they now say, notwithstanding that there's not a shred of evidence that Joe Biden did anything wrong, then they launch into whatever the question is.
Right.
And actually, the more the evidence piles up of his improper conduct, for example, getting paid by the company to save his son's job, or other examples, the more the evidence stack up, the more urgent they are in saying there is no evidence. And since no one in the media is the arbiter anymore, they all simply support the Democrat position, they can get away with doing that over and over again. There's not a shred of evidence that Joe Biden did anything wrong. Bunk. It's stacked up like cordwood.
So I'm glad to know that my memory isn't wrong and that this is new. What I sometimes will get calls or questions on is, how can they get away with saying this? Well, I guess they have a speech and debate clause that allows them pretty wide berth to say anything they want without much consequence.
And a media that
isn't
says, fine,
them.
We'll repeat your falsehood as though we had checked it out and we knew it was the truth.
Every major newspaper that will cover the Bobulinski testimony today will say tomorrow allegations without any proof.
Yep.
Every single one of them will have a similarity of that.
And it's a cynical move intended for the casual reader who doesn't, you know, they're into making a living and paying their bills and getting Johnny and Janie to their practices. And so they can't double check everything. So they rely on the media because they learned growing up the media would correct someone who told a bald-faced lie.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah, they kind of play loose with evidence and proof. Proof they get away with saying because there's been no adjudication in a court of law yet.
Right.
But the evidence, as you say, is stacked like cornwood. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. John Shattuck, Congressman Shattuck, has been my guest this hour. He and I were both seized by a column in the Wall Street Journal today by Walter Russell Mead. Walter Russell Mead's kind of interesting because he's not a conservative. He works over at the Brookings Institution, which is kind of the liberal version of the Heritage Foundation. He writes this: "The erosion of America's deterrent power and standing in the world isn't all Biden's fault. But his policies aren't reversing the decline. From the catastrophically bungled withdrawal from Afghanistan to the delay in sending advanced weapons to Ukraine in the face of Mr. Putin's threats, Mr. Biden's White House takes step after step that cumulatively teach friends and foes to see the U.S. as a declining power that is easily cowed and in retreat. Then there's the Middle East. The Red Sea is nearly closed. Gaza is in flames. A quasi-war simmers on Israel's northern border. Iranian militias gather strength in Iraq as Iran's ally Bashar al-Assad tightens his grip on Syria. Iran aids Russia's aggression in Ukraine while simultaneously strengthening ties with criminal groups and rogue regimes in the Western Hemisphere. As China thinks about the consequences of blockading Taiwan, it is carefully watching how Team Biden handles Iran. So far, it sees little to fear."
So I read the Wall Street Journal religiously every day. I read his column this morning, and it hit me like, they say, a ton of bricks. When you talk about the U.S. as a declining power, and he made the case so clearly, and the case under Biden is so stunningly clear, starting with Afghanistan and going all the way through to Ukraine and to the Middle East and now to Haiti, you read that column and you go, nobody who reads that column, and maybe people can find it without buying today's Wall Street Journal, but nobody who reads that column can say we're doing well in the world or that Biden has defended the nation and its standing or its reputation. No one can read that column without being worried about the future of this nation. And what I do when I love a column is I immediately get out the scissors.
You still scissors them?
I take them. There used to be this little, like, it was a tool that you could take articles out with, which was much faster than scissors. But I immediately cut it out and said, and toyed with myself. I used to send these columns when they'd hit me, I'd send them to my email list. But I think people got tired of them. But I'm telling you, this is a column you shouldn't miss if you care about where America's going, or if you're if you think that there's the slightest chance in the universe that you might vote for Biden or someone you know might vote for Biden, get this column and read it, because it is a devastating indictment. And there's no opinion in it. He doesn't say we did terrible in Afghanistan. He just says, take a look at Afghanistan. So you might disagree. You might say, well, I'm against forever wars, so I think what they've done on Ukraine is right. You would be wrong, but nonetheless, you might think that. But you go through the whole list, and you can't say to yourself, we are doing well as a nation. It is a litany of a declining power.
So the question first becomes, do people care? Second, it becomes, if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, does it actually fall in the forest? And the reason I ask that is yesterday there were other hearings on Capitol Hill where you had the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the former head of Central Command talking about the terrible and politically motivated withdrawal from Afghanistan that led to the deaths of 13 Americans, and we don't know how many allied friends of ours on the
countless.
Countless. They didn't know. And you have I said today, I said, you will not see a lot of press on this hearing today. It's nowhere to be
discussed. It's almost none.
There is almost none. And Joe Biden's most famous words on the withdrawal from Afghanistan are, it was an extraordinary success. Washington Post done fact check him on that kind of thing. And I suppose it's an extraordinary success in the fact that 14 Americans weren't killed. I don't know how he defines extraordinary success, but it was very
humiliating.
Clear.
And
humiliating.
You're
is
just
what it
a fiscal conservative. Outrageous in the amount of equipment and money.
All of
that
it.
We lost.
Every piece of it, and putting the Taliban back in power, which we spent 20 years trying to get out of power. So the point is, I don't know if there's no coverage of it because those two generals were indicting the political operation in the White House as being responsible, and the media doesn't cover it. No one's going to know about this story. And if they don't know, they can't care. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
No accountability. Pure and unadulterated name-calling or blaming, pointing the finger at the other guy, as if, their position in that hearing was, we did nothing wrong, we were compelled to do it by the White House, so are they supposed to just do everything the White House says without challenge it? But I think it's a very legitimate question as to, is anybody listening to any of this? Do you hear the tree fall if it falls in the forest? Because one of these is an issue still today, and that is what we're doing in Ukraine.
John, we had 3 days of no Secretary of Defense that no one cared about, and no one in the White House knew about it, and his number two didn't know about it, who had control and command and control of the Department of Defense. And the reason no one knew about it, obviously, is because they don't care about it.
The little cliche that runs the White House, and people stop me on the street and say, who's running the country?
Right.
Whatever little, and it's a little cliche of people for each different topic, for the environment or for national defense or whatever it is, they stay hidden and not even they care very much about where he is. But look at what we're doing in Ukraine right now. Republicans are refusing to look at what is happening in Ukraine. I guarantee you, if Russia crushes Ukraine as obviously, Putin thinks is more and more likely because now he's regularly threatening the use of nuclear power. If that happens, there is no non-nuclear country in the world that is safe. China will take Taiwan. North Korea will take South Korea. God knows where it all goes. And we're sitting on the sidelines saying, basically with Republicans saying, well, it's okay to let the nation decline. It's okay not to be the world leader. It's okay, even though we promised Ukraine when we took their nuclear weapons away from that we would defend them, it's okay to just stand by at the sideline and say that, well, because this might become an endless war, don't let it be an endless war. He's making it an endless war because the Congress isn't pushing him to do what's right, which is to tell Russia, you will not take another nation back into communism.
Thank you, John. Thank you for everything. Thanks for being here. It's good to see you, man.
Yeah.
I'm Seth. I'll have a concluding thought. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Thanks for spending some of your afternoon with us. Portions of this show brought to you by our good friends at Y Refi. Invest YRefi.com. Invest the letter Y, then Y, then REFY.com, or give them a call at 888-YREFI24. They have a heck of a investment opportunity. It's a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, and it's not correlated to the vicissitudes of the stock market or the caprice of the Federal Reserve. YRefi has also stepped up very generously to underwrite our event on March 26th, Fighting for Freedom with Mike Gallagher and Brandon Tatum. Myself will have some other special guests, so they've made the tickets incredibly affordable with their subsidy, and we thank them very much for that. So go to 960thepatriot.com, 960thepatriot.com. The event is next Tuesday. We look forward to seeing you there. Young David will be there. I'll introduce David around. To those of you that want to see young, who is this mythical, mysterious chimera named Young David? We will introduce him around. He will, as Lyndon Johnson said, press the flesh. I'm right about that, right? That was Lyndon Johnson pressing the flesh?
It sounds a little dangerous of a metaphor to be just
it
playing
meant
around
with. It meant handshaking. I think that was Lyndon Johnson. Shattuck would have known. I think it comes from Lyndon Johnson. But in any event, young David will do that, and he'll probably be in fascinating attire as he usually is.
Oh, probably just a suit
from like 1925.
Oh, shut up!
No, you do that. You do. You go.
I've got a lot of vintage clothes.
Yeah, you
in
do
my
go
closet.
Vintage.
Yes, and I'll probably be running around like a chicken with its head cut off. But I'm sure we'll all get to meet and greet each other. And that's not even the best part. You're forgetting the best part, which is our 2-for-1 offer going on right now. I've sent out a few emails about this, but if you're one of the lucky ones who hasn't caught my gaze and gotten an email from me, you're listening right now, and I'd love to give you a 2-for-1 deal. Use code APPRECIATION at checkout, put one ticket in your cart, and you'll get an automatically a second one of the same value absolutely free.
Great. Great. Any confusion on any of that, you can just email David, ddoll@salempx.com, ddoll@salempx.com. I wanted to end the show with a quote from that Walter Russell Mead piece in the Wall Street Journal. Crows cluster where scarecrows fail. If Team Biden wants a world with fewer challenges to the American order, it must restore respect for American power, competence, and will. That's step one. Step two, kill some crows. All right, folks, until tomorrow, God bless you all. On behalf of David, Mr. Bill, Teresa, I am Seth Leibson. Class dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.